Now, when housewives have the choice, looking back at times during which women at home had their own record request program, Housewives' Choice, 1957, Hollywood and Bust.
Hello, this is Russell Davis.
And Maureen Lipman, wading once again through a mountain of mothballs to bring you the scent of those far-off days when housewives have the choice.
Every weekday morning on the Light Programme at 9:10. Suddenly, it's 1957.
A year John Arlott greeted with no great joy in the News Chronicle.
All the year, people will love and be kind and laugh. Only those who do not, and those with big busts, will be news.
Has the cult of the bust gone too far?
Asked the journalist Jean Seward.
Without specifying whether she meant upwards, downwards, or outwards.
There'd probably never been a time when people were so obsessed with their dimensions.
If Americans go on eating the way they do, the average man within 1,000 years will weigh 26 stone, and woman nearly 25 stone.
This prophecy came from Don Grimes, president of the Independent Grocers Alliance, addressing a conference of macaroni manufacturers, and they should know.
An American will be 9'2" tall if the present rate of growth continues.
Getting past a joke, I think you'll agree.
Back in the present tense, Miss Average Britain, 1957, was revealed to be 5'3" tall, weighing 9 stone 4 pounds, with so-called vital statistics of 37, 27 and 3/4, 39.
But that was just a broad cross-section. I don't know whether it was anything to do with these contemporary obsessions, but I always did imagine this 1957 favourite being sung by a very fat woman in front of a mirror.
You, me, and I, we are my favorite people. We all go together like pigeons and cream, our bells with a church and a steeple. Some people I know I'm fond of, and so all day I keep singing about them. For one of them's you, and darling, it's true, I find that I can't live without them. You, me, and us, we are my favorite people. We all go together like peaches and cream, our bells with a church and a steeple. The stars were as bright as diamonds the night we met, and we danced and we flirted. With one look at you, my dream had come true, and nothing will ever divert it. You, me, and us, we are my favorite people. We all go together like peaches and cream, our bells with a church and a steeple. Now outside of town, we've all settled down. Our place isn't big, but it's cozy. I know that you're mine, and everything's fine. Our future forever is rosy. You, me, and us, we are my favorite people. We all go together like peaches and cream, our bells through the church and a steeple. Yes, we all go together like peaches and cream. You, me, and us.
One of 1957's top requests by Alma Cogan.
Who, on a TV show in May, caught her 500 pounds pink ostrich feather gown on a nail while making an entrance.
Viewers saw Alma immobilized for nearly a minute. Finally, she went forward to the microphone, holding the 2 yards of torn gown in front of her. Somehow she managed to keep herself respectable as she linked arms with dancers for her next song,
Too Close for Comfort.
The start of the year, you, me, and us, had a transport problem.
After the Suez invasion, our oil supplies had dried up and petrol was severely rationed.
In spite of which, cars were prominent in the news. Big ones?
Joan Collins buys Pink Thunderbird.
Small ones?
The three-wheel Heinkel bubble car costs £398 and does 100 miles per gallon.
Some as big as your reputation.
Most startling baby car in London is tennis player Angela Buxton's Agatha III. She's had it sprayed blancmange pink.
Very much the colour of the year.
It's easier to find in crowded car parks,
she said. Agatha's one and two?
They were bikes.
Miss Buxton's baby car was probably the Goggomobile, a new import from Bavaria. People laughed at them, but in time of shortage, they certainly made your gallon go further.
In the meantime, though, there was a 20% increase in rail travel, in spite of the traditional difficulties which were experienced even by those in the most exalted office.
Stephen Wade, who is the man who produces Sunday Night at the London Palladium on commercial TV, wanted to go to Folkestone. It was slightly foggy, so the train was more than an hour late.
"Dash it,"
said Mr. Wade to a railway official.
"I don't know why you bothered to print a timetable at all."
Mr. Wade got the classic reply.
"How would you know the train was late otherwise?"
Trains certainly did run better on a turntable. This one more or less took off.
Freight train, going so fast. Freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Would you tell me where he's gone? Don't know where he's heading for. What he's done against the law. Got no future, got no hope. Just nothing but the road. Freight train, going so fast. Freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Won't you tell me where he's gone? He lost his reason, lost his life. He killed his friends in mortal strife. He must have moved like the rolling star, just to wait until he dies. Freight train, going so fast. Freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Won't you tell me where he's gone? When he dies, just bury him, please. Way down the end of Old Chestnut Street. Poplars at his head and feet, and tell him he's gone to sleep. Freight train, going so fast. Freight train, going so fast. I don't know what train he's on. Won't you tell me where he's gone?
Nancy Whiskey with the Chas McDevitt Skiffle Group and one of the several train songs of 1957.
The new skiffle craze thrived on the many train legends in the folk song repertoire, but what it really lived on was coffee.
Since the first espresso machine was imported into this country in April 1952,
explained the News Chronicle,
coffee bars have sprung up in their hundreds all over London.
The Mocha in Fifth Street, Soho, laid claim to being the first, but by now it was too late to tell. They were none of them very big or licensed for dancing. So, in the early days of 1957, the birth of a new art form was announced to the public.
With hand jive,
said Cecilia Lowes, an Oxford Street shop girl,
you've got to be neat and knowledgeable to get across how you're reacting.
You also have to remember to put down your cup of coffee before you started. The BBC's new pop programme, 6-5 Special, now showed the hand jive in action. The TV critic, Peter Black, was not impressed with the show.
I suppose it satisfied the poor devils who had nothing better to do than look at it.
He groaned in a judgment that has stood ever since as the least anyone can say about any TV programme.
The focus of the entire youth cast was 19-year-old Tommy Steele. Oh, so his publicity said.
Actually, I'm 20,
said Tommy, who could not tell a lie. Described by one reporter as
a slim youth with fair, carefully tousled hair,
Tommy came from Bermondsey,
where the pseudonymous smoothie chops diarist Paul Tanfield of the Daily Mail called on him.
I visited Tommy in his terrace house in Freen Street, Bermondsey. He does not drink or smoke and spends most of his time watching television at home. As there is no bathroom in the house, Tommy considers it quite in order to pop around the corner for a sixpenny bath in the public washhouse.
I should hope so.
This week he will earn £500.
Or 20,000 baths. Mr. Tanfield kept up this promising contact.
Over the telephone yesterday, Tommy Seal sang me a tune from his rock and roll wardrobe. His socks, shirts and shoes are printed and embroidered with musical notes. First he sang his socks. I didn't think much of it. Neither did he.
No,
he said.
It's not very good. The shirts are much better.
Mrs. Seal's shirts, besides being more musical than his socks, are also decorated with alligators. His shoes, he said, are bright blue with music notes printed on the toe caps. They cost 49 and 11 pence.
Or £2.49.
In the past 3 days, over 1,000 similar pairs have been sold. No comment.
Still, you couldn't blame Tommy. He was a cheerful, down-to-earth character from old Bermondsey.
Sort of the, what?
Oh, absolute.
Rather.
Unfortunately, nobody had bothered to check whether there was a studio to audition him or anything like that. So, we had to take him up to an artist's restroom. And there, he and a bass player and a drummer appeared, and he started to sing. He sang, in fact, Rock with the Caveman, which was the very first thing he recorded for us. And although I hadn't heard this on a microphone, I knew nothing about whether this voice would record or any of the other so-called technical problems. To me, there was such absolutely fabulous magic. This was a performance, you know. Everybody was being rude about rock and roll. I'm happy to say that I wasn't at that time. But this was such a magical performance and such a dynamic personality that he'd only got through about one chorus. And I said, yes, yes, this is it. This is absolutely perfect.
Hugh Mendel remembering the frightfully good audition Tommy Steele gave, with a view to making some of those funny little plastic things that spin round and make you a lot of money.
I've written nearly all my own songs,
Tommy assured the press.
Rock with the Caveman, Doomsday Rock, Rock Around the Town, Wedding Bells, I've got a new kind of rhythm in that one.
Tell us more, do.
Got a handful of songs to sing you. Can't stop a voice when it longs to sing you. Blues songs and blues songs and songs to bring you happiness. No monoliths, moreover, wherever we may roam to, or any shore where we may be blown to, we'll know that we're gonna feel at home to Rockefeller. Music, jazz and cha-cha-jazz, calypsos and street vendor cries, strains of old refrains, sleepy time baby lullabies. Got a handful of songs to sing you. I've got a heart full of love to bring you. True love for you, love and love's a thing you keep. So here's a handful of songs, go and cheat. Just a handful of songs, just a handful of songs, only a handful of songs.
A Housewife's Choice hit of 1957, Tommy Steele's Handful of Songs. The record industry suddenly boomed.
Demand for records generally has gone up, so staggeringly that, frankly, we haven't got the plant at the moment to meet it,
said Alan Freeman.
Not that one.
The ominously titled exploitation chief at Pye Nixer Records.
American artists were touring Britain in swift rotation.
Not always welcomed by local critics. Kenneth Alsop, a jazz fan at heart, described Bill Haley as
a turnip-shaped man with a shiny face, a cast in his left eye, and, to balance, that tress of yellow hair coiled like a caterpillar over his right eyebrow.
Apart from that, he looked a knockout. Mr. Haley was the middle-aged exception, as the touring artists were getting younger and younger.
The Canadian pipsqueak, Paul Anka, suddenly famous for his international hit Diana, was just 16 as he stepped off the plane.
To be confronted by none other than Humphrey Burton.
Beethoven's flight must have been delayed.
I know you're still a very young man, but I would like to ask you, first of all, there's an awful lot of talk in that song, Diana, of yours about love. Have you, in fact, got a girlfriend?
Well, she isn't exactly my girlfriend. She's a good friend of mine, and I wrote it, maybe you can say, as a dare or as a joke.
You mean the song, Diana, is dedicated to an actual girl called Diana?
Yes, it is.
Oh, that certainly explains some of the feeling within it. Now, a young man like you, who's already got a lot of success behind you, how did you break into show business so early?
Well, I've been singing since I was 10 years old in concerts and plays and different theaters back home in Ottawa, Canada. And I had been writing some songs, and I asked my father if I could go to New York and see if I could get them published. And when I went down to New York, I went around to the different record companies, and I came upon ABC Paramount, and they listened to me, and they not only wanted the songs, they asked me if I'd record, and I was really glad to.
Now, what are your plans while you're here in this country?
Well, while I'm here, I'll be doing a week's performance in Liverpool at the Empire Theatre. Then I'll be touring up to Glasgow and different parts of Great Britain.
A last question, Paul. What's the future for you? What's your big ambition in life?
Well, I hope to remain as popular here in England and friendly with the people here as I have been, and to make more records. And I'd like to write bigger songs. By that I mean maybe something for a musical or some big ballad. I hope to do that someday, and I'd like to continue in music.
You take composition to be more important than performance?
Well, not really important. It's just for my satisfaction to be able to write a real perfect song.
And he went on to write the English words for My Way.
So, something must have gone wrong somewhere.
British Housewives took to Mr. Anker's hit, Not At All. You could count the requests for it on the fingers of Stutty.
There was too much to do coping with the needs of rapidly growing post-war babies, now well into their school days. Some of us in Hull.
Some in Manchester.
And young Prince Charles in Cheam, where the price of his new school uniform, bought at a Knightsbridge store, was put at
£22.08,
including a cap at 14 and 11, a blazer at £4.03, and socks with no music notes or alligators at 5 and 6 a pair.
In his corduroy shorts,
£1.15.
Prince Charles was not yet a candidate for schoolyard romance, but in an older age group, this was getting to be a real problem.
The papers were full of unlicensed passions between girls from Class 4C and spotty plumbers of 19.
While the richer sort of cad and cradle snatcher took off with his girl in his souped-up goggomobile to Gretna Green.
It was all part of a vast public puberty, a giant swoon to the tune of Tab Hunter.
Oh, I think he's lovely.
He's giving up the films, you know.
I know, to make more records of her.
Have you got his autograph, Michelle Proud, for us?
They say for every boy and girl there's just one love in this whole world, and I know I found mine. The heavenly touch of your embrace tells me no one could take your place. Ever in my heart, young love, first love, ever true devotion. One kiss from your sweet lips will tell me that your love is real, and I can feel that it's true. We will vow to one another, there will never be another love for you. Thank you.
Cab Hunter.
Real name, Arthur Gellion.
Who was actually discovered as an actor in the late 40s, and by now was positively ancient at 26.
By midsummer, the record had sold 2.5 million copies overall.
And was one of the instances where the housewife's taste did coincide with the hit parade. There was no pleasing everybody with the programme, particularly in terms of the style of presentation. Fleet Street was watching the disc jockey's every move.
BBC disc jockey Archie McCulloch signed off yesterday at the end of a week of putting on records for Housewife's Choice with the following words.
And now I suppose you'll have to get back to the sink. Never mind, it's Friday and the weekend is coming, so you can have a long lie-in on Sunday.
How patronising can you get?
Said that man Tanfield again. Internally, the Housewife's Choice office was somewhat embarrassed by a request put through private channels by the well-known actor David Tomlinson. Anna Instone, head of gramophone programmes, had to turn it down.
I'm very sorry that it's impossible to make an exception to the absolute rule under which all those who write for a record in Housewife's Choice stand an equal chance. I suggest you return the card and ask them to send it in immediately in the normal way.
Whereupon David Tomlinson, in what looked in retrospect like a fit of pique, but was surely an accident, went for a spin in his Tiger Moth biplane and crashed it spectacularly at the bottom of his own garden.
Cleared of a charge of dangerous flying, he promised never to do it again, whatever it had been. And the remains of the plane were removed by Fred Spoon's EPNS.
Oh, any old iron. You look neat, talk about a creep. You look never from your dappy to your feet. Dressed in style, brand new tile, and your father's old green tie on. I wouldn't give you something for your old watch chain, old iron. Cool. Just a week or two ago, my poor Uncle Bill went and kicked the bucket and he left me in his will. The other day, I popped around to see for a honey chain. She said, your Uncle Bill has left you a watch and chain. I put it on right across my vest. Thought I'd look it down there as it dangled on my chest. Just to flash it off, I started walking around about. A lot of kiddies followed me and all began to chat. Any old iron, mate, any old iron. Any old iron. You look neat to talk about the creep. You look dapper from your napper to your feet. You're twisting tall with a brand new tile in your paw, but old green tie on. I wouldn't give it something for your old watch chain.
And now, Fred Spoons would like to give you a solo. Well, Fred.
I'd like to continue the rhythmic melody what you just heard on my melody spoons. Thank you.
Go on, let me hear that EPNS, Fred. Oh, temperamental, innit?
Oh, any old iron. You look neat, talk about street. Yim bomb diddle on your feet. You look nice, dressed in ice. A father's old green tie on. I wouldn't give you something for your old watch chain. Old iron. Oh, you look neat, talk about creep. You look dapper from your napper free. But you got an old green tie, there with you in your eye. Got a monocle that's sticking in your old bench boy. Put your little shoes, blue straight shoes. Don't you roll me, daddy-o, rock away your boots. You got a lolly for the rain and a brand new cane. Oh, I wouldn't give you cup for your old watch chain. Old iron.
Oh, mate, I've been spun to.
Peter Sellers, presenting Mates Spoffle Group, featuring Fred Spoon's EPNS with Any Old Iron, the title of a BBC radio documentary of the period.
Featuring Bill Bland, not played by Sellers, though he could have been. He was a genuine junk man.
Before the war, and still today, a shrunken head, it was worth, you could get anything up to, for a good shrunken head, anything, or up to 50, 60 pounds for a good one, before the war.
Now that was the heyday of the shrunken head.
Before the war.
Talking of shrunken heads, the journalist Henry Fairley paid a visit to Oxford in 1957 and wrote it up in the Daily Mail.
There is one aspect of the overcrowding of Oxford which is even more alarming than the general problem. That is the ever-increasing number of women undergraduates. It is seriously forecast in Oxford that within the lifetime of many of us, these ungainly creatures will outnumber the male undergraduates. At that moment, Oxford will cease to be what she is already ceasing to be.
She, you notice, there's a cheek.
One of the few remaining bastions in this country against a matriarchal society. The more women undergraduates there are, the more certainly pernickety intellects will replace the receptive, free-ranging minds of the past. The more certainly fashions and ideas as well as behavior will replace individuality.
Most of the replies to this extraordinary statement, which went on to refer to the
department store mind,
which a female-dominated Oxford would produce, were fairly temperate ones from men.
But oddly enough, in the same paper came the first rumblings of an objection to the word housewife.
Housewife? The name's an insult,
wrote Mr. Louis Henderson of Corwin Bay.
And several female correspondents agreed.
I entirely agree with Mr. Henderson,
wrote Mrs. Bourne of Ware.
We live on a boat, so what am I? A boat wife?
Mrs. Jackson of Reading brought the argument uncomfortably close to home.
Housewife is an insult, like the German Hausfrau we used to refer to with contempt before the war. Nowadays, it simply means drudge, and people like Godfrey Wynne drool over her on Housewife's Choice every day. Even spinster is preferable to housewife.
Housewife isn't their choice, said the heading on the letters column. But on balance, Daily Mail readers did have to put up with a daily diet of maleness, especially from the paper's resident topical misogynist, Lane Norcott.
Throw mama from the train, a kiss, a kiss. Wave mama from the train, a goodbye. Throw mama from the train a kiss, a kiss. And don't cry, my baby, don't cry. How I miss that sweet lady with her old country touch. Mr. Quite broken English called Pennsylvania Dutch. I can still see her there at the station that day, calling out to her baby as the train pulled away. Throw mama from the train a kiss, a kiss. Dry mama all your tears, won't you try? Throw mama from the train a kiss, a kiss. And eat mama up on her pie. Can't believe that she's gone now, it's a lonely old town. Keeps looking down, 'cause whenever I happen to be passing through, I could swear she was there with the warmth I once knew. And I throw mama from the train a kiss, wave mama from the train a goodbye. Throw mama from the train a kiss, a kiss. And she throws one back from a pie.
I'm not sure whether that record by Patty Page was requested because listeners liked it or because they couldn't quite believe it.
It wasn't quite called Throw Mama from the Train, but it was close.
Mama from the Train, anyway, was another instance of housewives defying the hit parade.
Among the women in the news were several actresses whose fates were ultimately melancholy. But for the time being, they were riding high, and indeed causing melancholy fates on their own account.
Film star Jane Mansfield was snapped at a New York charity ball by 76-year-old photographer Arthur Conkright. As his camera clicked, he collapsed and died.
Yes, he conked right out, which was more or less the effect the publicity men were always looking for.
Marilyn Monroe had withdrawn into seclusion with Arthur Miller.
But she was still influential in France. where a new regulation actually made it illegal to call your child Marilyn.
Even if it was a boy.
Marlene was still allowed.
The actress Jean Seberg arrived in London by BOAC plane, having written a poem en route, which, in the manner of the actresses of the day, she handed over to pressmen, minus the last line, which was...
simply too embarrassing.
The remainder went like this.
I run too fast, I fly so high, I hit so hard, too wide my eye, too full my heart, too deep the pain, so short the kiss.
So late the train would have been the topical suggestion for the missing line. Newspaper readers were asked what their conclusion would be, with a £5 prize for the winner.
Alfida Zane was a popular solution.
And Ye Gods the Strain, a satirical one.
But the fiver went to...
Oh, love, make plain.
For some unfathomable reason. Miss Seberg, with great delicacy, commented that it was such an original line that she could never have thought of it.
At a slightly less exalted level of glamour, the comedian Hilda Baker made the headlines.
Hilda Baker, now topping the bill at the Nottingham Empire, has been banned from one of the city's leading hotels because of her pet monkeys.
Like the goons, Miss Baker had monkeys on the knees.
I refuse to be parted from them. They are like children to me. We have stayed in the best hotels in London and the provinces, and this is the first time anybody has objected.
The monkeys have a bed in her room and do not get up until she does. Then she gives them a morning wash with scented soap.
She could have taken them round to the bath for sixpence.
Neatest self-publicist of the year was a songwriter.
Mr. Alan Lerner, who produced the My Fair Lady smash hit on Broadway, stopped off in London the other day long enough to buy a Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud and say,
last week we had our first empty seat for 2 years. Boy, were we concerned. I asked the lady in the next seat if it was hers.
My husband,
she said.
But he died 2 days ago and I couldn't get any of his friends to come. They all went to the funeral. The boys of Redruth Grammar School in Cornwall were polled on their current heroes and heroines.
Florence Nightingale
was top heroine, followed by
Joan of Arc, Sabrina, and Mother.
Group Captain Douglas Bader
topped the heroes poll, pursued by
Sir Winston Churchill, Nelson, Stanley Matthews, Elvis Presley, and Tommy Steele,
who was ejected from the majestic hotel St. Anne's-on-Sea in July for playing the xylophone at 2 a.m.
I blame those monkeys.
But it was nice out anyway. 70-degree temperatures had been recorded in early March, and by July, some areas were getting their hottest day since the early 1920s. 96 degrees.
There have been complaints to the police that teenagers hold midnight nude bathing parties and dance on the sands at Westwood Hole, North Devon.
Said one resident.
I have no objection to nude bathing, but I do object to bathers singing in the mood during the early hours of the morning.
Mood, did you say, or in the nude? I'll bet that in the course of their moonlight recital, they did sing this.
On a day like today, we pass the time away, writing love letters in the sand. How you laugh when I cried each time I saw the time take our love letters from the sand.
Boone with a song that dated from 1931, making it 3 years older than Fat Boone himself.
Charles Eugene Boone, as he'd started out, was already a married man with three daughters, so not everything about the youth cult was undomesticated.
But most things tried to be, especially books and films. A particular kind of lurid paperback dates from 1957, and the journalist Kenneth Alsop described it.
The girl on the shiny book jacket had a body like an egg timer filled with custard. She was coiled on a divan, directing flamethrower eyes at a lean man with a sardonic shark face the colour of a very old saddle. Something one sensed was about to happen. But when I plucked the paperback from its rack and scanned the story, I found that the picture represented a psyllium breeder from Chislehurst named Veronica, and Mark, the pipe-smoking idealistic young architect she eventually marries, after many misunderstandings of startling boredom. This, stripping Veronica of her whipcord breeches and displaying her in satin stretched to vibration point across her torso, is known as merchandising.
New vogue word. In America, the actress Arlene Dahl felt she'd been merchandised, and in New York's Supreme Court, she sued Columbia Pictures for £357,000.
The picture she'd been making had been called Portrait in Smoke, but by the time they released it, it had turned into Wicked as They Come.
Her attorneys said Miss Dahl's face appeared on posters superimposed on a sketch of a body which had no likeness to hers. She said,
I've always played dignified and ladylike parts.
Accordingly, she was suing to redeem her reputation for
good grace, dignity, personal modesty, refinement, culture, and artistic ability.
Judge Greenberg ruled against her.
The first Russian space satellite, known later as a Sputnik, but for now just as the Bleep.
British scientists did their best to keep track of the Bleep, its orbit, how fast it was going, and whether it was falling, which at first it seemed to be doing at an alarming rate. But a certain amount of human error had crept in.
Dr. Martin Ryle, FRS, director of the Mollard Radio Astronomical Laboratory at Cambridge, confesses that for 2 days all his team's complex calculations were wrong, because they forgot the Earth is round.
Among so many sets of figures, one set, allowing for the curvature of the Earth, was overlooked.
Distracted by female undergraduates, no doubt.
Well, perhaps our minds really weren't on the job in 1957. We had strange national obsessions, among which cows bulked large.
Drink more milk!
Was the big advertising campaign of the moment, with Zoe Newton, a young blonde mum with a fringe, doing all the posters. Midland housewives, when polled on the matter, recommended abolishing Zoe Newton in favour of
a sleek, well-groomed cow.
But not everywhere in the Midlands were the beasts treated with such consideration. At the Nottingham Dairy Festival, pedigree cows stood politely waiting in a hot marquee when
the Lord Mayor, Alderman William Bickling, walked into the tent and pressed a button to open the show. Immediately, the cows began to dance and bellow. They jumped and wriggled, mooed and snorted. And the civic party, including Britain's milk girl, Zoe Newton, looked on in astonishment.
An electrical fault caused by TV aerials fitted to a temporary water tank had been giving them short, sharp shocks through the milking equipment.
They must have been getting 100 volts every time it short-circuited,
said an engineer. Even unluckier cows near the Windscale power station started producing radioactive milk when some dust escaped from the atomic pile.
15,000 gallons of milk were pumped out to sea as a precautionary measure. And a desperate cow hunt went on in Devon when 5 atomic cows were sold by accident at Exeter Market.
People began to take a serious interest in this controversial animal. There were 2,600,000 dairy cows in Britain, it was revealed.
The average yield was 720 gallons a year. A pint bottle cost sixpence to make, and its average life was 40 journeys.
The actress Dawn Adams stormed out of the Cork Film Festival because they wouldn't organise a milk bath for her.
Such extravagance would anger the unemployed and horrify the housewives,
said the festival council.
Some people here are going short of milk.
The idea is in poor taste,
added festival organiser Dermot Breen.
It's not even a good gimmick.
That is an insult,
retorted the star.
It was my idea. I thought of it when I heard there was a glut of milk here.
Then off she stormed to Dublin
in search of a milk stout.
Above her, in the airwaves, Russ Hamilton was gently mooing.
When the moon takes the place of the sun in the sky, I'll call for my girlie, we'll go walking by to a place no one knows. That's how love goes. Now we are alone. We will make love. Oh, yes, we will make love. I wish we could wed, but we are too young. But one day I know wedding bells will be rung. For you and for me, we'll promise to be so faithful and true. I love you. Oh, yes, I love you. Now it's getting late, now we must part. But before I go, I will leave you my heart. So don't shed a tear, I'll always be near. I'll hold you so tight, and I'll kiss you goodnight. Oh, yes, I'll kiss you goodnight. When I go away, don't ever let your heart go astray, 'cause my love so true is only for you. So remember you're mine, you're mine all the time. When the sun takes the place of the moon in the sky, we'll go on a journey, you and I, to a far distant land where our dreams were planned in the clouds up above. We will make love. Oh, yes, we will make love. Oh, yes, we will make love.
Fruity Russ Hamilton.
Formerly Butlin's red coat Ron Hume from Liverpool.
With a record that sold a million and shared top place in housewives' affections too.
In a TV unpopularity poll for 1957, Malcolm Muggeridge took the prize.
Second place going to Bob Monkhouse, who was accused of
oily ogling.
Surely not. With TV programming on the increase, the Daily Mail received the following letter.
Sir, now that lunchtime television is here, millions of people will, as Peter Black foreshadows, be eating most of their meals with eyes glued to what he calls the goggle box. This may prove a good thing, for if their attention is divided, they are likely to eat more slowly than usual, and their food will be more thoroughly masticated. But there are snags. They may be overexcited by what they goggle at, and start gulping and getting indigestion. Or they may get emotionally upset, which would be even worse for their digestion. They may even goggle so intently that they forget to eat at all, which would be plain silly.
This was actually signed
A Doctor.
And possibly marks his first appearance long before he joined Private Eye. Against the flow of TV propaganda, it was hard for radio to keep its profile high. But Housewife's Choice earned one very prominent piece of coverage in a not entirely fortunate way.
Paul Adam blots his copybook. It was 9:20 a.m. when the bedside phone jangled yesterday in the Muse flat of society band leader Paul Adam, and a groping hand picked up the receiver. A very sleepy band leader heard an excited caller ask,
"What about Housewife's Choice then, Mr. Adam?"
The man who calls himself the Deb's Delight realized he'd let down more than 6 million housewives. At 9:10, he should have been on the air. He was out of his bed, into his clothes, and out of the flat in such a hurry that he forgot his keys and wallet. A taxi got him to Broadcasting House in time to hear light program announcer Ronald Fletcher say the next record would be...
"Why should I care?"
Paul Adam returned sadly home to bed. A couple of hours later, he was about again, explaining the cause of it all. The coming-out dance at Claridge's for 18-year-old Miss Jacqueline Ansley, daughter of the millionaire banker Mr. George Ansley.
"It was a wonderful night,"
said Mr. Adam.
"All the best people were there. We should have stopped playing at 4 a.m., but they asked me to keep on till 6. I got so very tired, I decided to put my feet up. I don't remember any more till the phone rang."
It wasn't the first time, the papers reminded him. 7 years before, he'd been 10 minutes late.
"I'm annoyed with the BBC, though. They could have rung me when they saw I was missing."
Perhaps he had a point there.
Did they perhaps want him to blot his copybook definitively at last? We shall never know. But compare his escapade with the heroic professionalism of not-yet-super-famous Noel Gordon.
Noel Gordon, hostess of ITV's Lunchbox, threw a message out of a train window as it went through Martin Junction near Rugby yesterday. It was written in eyebrow pencil. She asked someone to phone her studio saying the train was an hour late. The message got through.
Of course it did. If you miss that one, you'll never get another one.
sweet Dora B. She said, tomorrow I'm going to sweet matrimony. But if you act all right, or you can take me out tonight, we could wine and dine and get back in time for the last train to San Fernando. Last train to San Fernando. Last train to San Fernando. If you miss this one, you'll never get another one. Dee-dee-dee-dee-bum-bum to San Fernando.
Duncan and the Bluegrass Boys, arriving at the end of 1957, the year we lost
Picture Post,
Bertolt Brecht,
Rob Wilton,
Jack Buchanan,
Sibelius,
Dior,
Chekhov's sister,
and Laika, the first space dog.
While we gained
intercontinental ballistic missiles,
an Asian flu.
Jimmy Young poured boiling fat over his arm in the south of France.
Benny Hill had his appendix out in Great Yarmouth. And Mrs. Jacqueline Adam, no relation to the belated bandleader, knitted the first all-electric spring vest from 700 yards of plastic-covered wire.
It was knitted on number 4 needles and designed by Dr. Heinz Wolf of Hampstead. Anything else you want to know about 1957?
Has mercifully faded from the memory.
So, this is Russell Davis.
And Maureen Lipman.
Saying goodbye.
Good luck.
And don't worry, it was all a long time ago.